Thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Lena Zentel. I'm the chair of PACSAW, the President's Advisory Committee on the Status of Women. And in a nutshell, PACSAW works to improve the climate and opportunities for women at UCOP. And one of the things we do is present the Women We Admire speaker series. And I'd like to thank the subcommittee members who are here today for putting this on, and that's Erin Marnoka and Alicia Shi and Margaret Wu, who are all here today. Let's see, what else? Oh, there's logistics that I need to cover. So if anybody's calling in, please put yourself on mute so you don't embarrass yourself typing or anything while Yvette's trying to talk. So our speaker today is the fabulous, wonderful Yvette Gula, the Vice Provost and Chief Outreach Officer of Diversity and Engagement. And she'll be speaking and then leave some time at the end for questions. So let me turn the mic over to my colleague, Jocelyn Serla-Benaria, who will introduce Yvette.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for taking time out of your lunch to attend today's session. As she said, my name is Jocelyn Serla-Benaria, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Academic Senate here at UC. Today, I'm honored and humbled to be introducing an amazing woman. I first knew of Yvette Gulat over 20 years ago when I was a student at UC Berkeley, and she oversaw the tutors at the Student Learning Center. Yvette has deep roots here at the University of California and has worked for 20 years on policy, strategic partnerships, and program design and delivery that improve student learning and achievement. Currently, Yvette is the Vice Provost for Diversity and Engagement. She is also the Chief Outreach Officer for the entire UC system. What a long title. What do you do? Well, in this role, she provides vision, direction, leadership, and oversight of strategies and approaches for the UC system that advance access, diversity, and inclusion. Yvette was recruited to the Office of the President from UC Berkeley following the passage of Proposition 209. Does everyone know what Proposition 209 is or was? Well, for those of you who don't know, it was the law that was passed for in our area that prohibited us to use race in our admissions. So she was brought over to help scale up UC's existing college preparation programs and create new ones to help more underrepresented, low-income, educational disadvantaged, and undocumented students prepare for admission to selective colleges and universities, including UC. Oops,
second page, sorry. I thought we had a podium.
Okay. Since joining Office of the President, Yvette has held a variety of system-wide roles, including Vice Provost for Educational Partnerships and Director for Student Academic Preparation and Educational Partnerships. Before joining the Office of the President, Yvette worked at UC Berkeley in a number and variety of student affairs positions, including Tutorial Services Coordinator for Student Athletes and Academic Coordinator and Director for the Early Academic Outreach Program. Yvette consults with organizations in California and throughout the nation on academic pipeline issues and strategies. She's amazing. She holds a BA, MA, PhD in English from UC Berkeley. Go Bears.
Go Bears.
Not only Yvette is all this, she is a fabulous mentor. She is great at collaborating, and she knows how to work in this UC environment. She has given me great advice over the years to help me with my higher ed career. And now, someone who I've admired and keep admiring, Yvette Gulat, our speaker today.
Jocelyn, can you hear me? Is that good enough? Okay. Well, thank you so much, Jocelyn, for that great introduction. I do. I remember meeting Jocelyn when she was
an undergraduate. I've known her ever since then. She was
Jocelyn Serla years ago. So that introduction reminds me I probably have to update my bio, because one of the things that, and I want to thank PACSAW for the opportunity to be here, one of the things this requires you to do is reflect back on your career. And it occurs to me, I've worked at the university for almost 30 years, and I have held a variety of roles. I have been a blank assistant once. I have been a
administrative assistant. I have been an analyst. I have been every level of student affairs officer, 1, 2, 3, 4. I have been an associate director. I have been an assistant director. I have been a deputy and chief of staff to a VP. I have been an assistant and associate VP, and I've been a vice provost in 2 titles. It's been a long career. I thought I'd share with you a couple of things about what I've learned in advancing through the University of California, and share with you some stories, and maybe embarrass a few of you because the room is filled with people I've worked with for a number of years, and so I have lots of stories to share. But one is that I've always been able to do what I love most of the time. Most of the time. And for me, that's about impacting the ability of students in our state to be here, to thrive at this university, and to go on to contribute to the state of California. And I've been able to do that my entire career. I've also learned things from everyone I've worked with, even the people who it might not have been so pleasurable to work for. There's something to be taken from every experience. And the third is that I've had a lot of champions in my career. Nobody advances by themselves. And so I'll share with you some stories about that. The role of champions in your career is so important. And those are the 3 takeaways as I've moved my way through this variety of roles and done mostly what I've loved. So I know in these settings we're supposed to talk about like who we are and where we're from. The hardest question that I ever answer, and Pamela Jennings will appreciate that, is where are you from? That's a really hard question for me to answer because my father was an Air Force career military person. And we lived all over the world. My father worked in intelligence, which meant that he was a very quiet person. One time he had to have an appendectomy. And when we went to visit him in the hospital, there's a young airman who sat there with a tape recorder in case my father mumbled anything while he was unconscious. When we moved places, they wiretapped our phones. And because he worked in intelligence, we moved all the time. So as a young child, I lived in England and Japan and Germany and Italy and Greece. And I didn't really come to the United States until I was about 13 years old. And I didn't want to come to the United States because I was afraid of America. When you live abroad, and you live in a military life, your life is both expanded and constrained at the same time, right? Because a military base is an entire ecosystem. There's nothing you can't do on a military base. There's one newspaper. And what's it called, Pamela? The Stars and Stripes. The Stars and Stripes. So you spend your entire life in this ecosystem. And so we had, my father got reassigned to Travis Air Force Base here in California. And we lived on Crete at the time. And the only thing we knew about California was that everyone was on drugs. Because the only television we watched was Dragnet. So my sisters and I, made arrangements to live with a family in Greece because there was no way we were coming to California. And so my father pulled out a map and he showed us where in California we live. It was very far from L.A., so we were reassured. But when I came here, I never lived anywhere for a long period of time. So I had an actual really spotty education because we moved so much. Sometimes we would leave in the middle of a year, sometimes in the middle of a semester. So I didn't really have a great education growing up. What I was a reader because military bases have libraries, and I read a lot. So when I came to California, I had no sense of anything. My father, I mentioned, is a really quiet man. He's probably said in his life maybe 25 words to me. So one of the things my father used to do, my father worked in intelligence, as I said, so he would often get deployed, what they call TDY, right, temporary tours of duty. And we would write him letters, dutifully write his letter, and we would get these answers back directly in response to our letters. So if we said, "Dear Daddy, how are you?" the answer was, "Dear Yvette, I am fine." So my father is not someone who talks a lot. But my father did say to me one time, he sat me down, and he said, "I think you could go to college." And I went, "Okay, what's college?" Right? Why is this man talking to me? Why are we having this conversation? remembered that through my life. So my father never once, never ever again told me he thought I could go to college, but he made sure that I could, right? He made sure that I could. So if I ever struggled, my father was always there to sort of get me back in check. He always made sure that I could buy books, right? We were a moderate family, moderate income family. We didn't have a lot of money for extra things. I remember when I did go to college, I wanted to make a ski trip. And I called my father, because I went to, and I'll tell you about that. I went to a college in Colorado, and I called my father, and I said, well, everyone wants to go to Breckenridge and go skiing, so I'd like to go, and I need some extra money. And my father said, oh. He turns to my sister, he goes, Edie, you know those volleyball shoes you need? You can't have them because Yvette wants to go skiing.
Oh.
I'm like, okay, I understand. I understand. Okay. But because I didn't come from a family that went to college, and because I didn't come from an environment where college was the norm, where I grew up, I went to military school. They're American schools, but they're military schools. And so everybody wants to do what? Join the military or marry someone who's in the military. There are two, those are really your two options. And if you're a strong student, you're likely to go off to the academies. But very few students just went off to college. They either joined the military, worked in civil service, or married someone in the military. So when I was in high school, I was a good student, but I wasn't a great student. But I did well on a test, and all of a sudden I was a candidate for national merit. And so my counselor says, oh, look, you could go anywhere. And I said, oh, no, I'm going to go to the University of Denver. This is what we now call in the lexicon undermatching. And they said, but you could go to Brown, you could go to Stanford, you could go to Berkeley. I said, oh, no, I'm going to go to the University of Denver. And that's where I went. I spent my first 2 years in college at the University of Denver and hated it. And so I came home, and I didn't have anything to do. So I watched Oprah, and I worked at the mall. And my father said, you can't do this. You need to go to school. And I said, well, where's there to go to school? He said, well, we'll just drive to Berkeley. I said, okay. So we drive to Berkeley. We park behind a Dwinnell. I walk on campus. I go, okay, I'll go here. And so I transferred to Berkeley, and it was amazingly transformative because, first, I met really smart people, and I met students who were really ambitious, and I discovered this whole world of literature I'd never, ever read in my entire life. Books by black writers, for example. That wasn't part of what was in the military library or talked about in the Stars and Stripes. And so I was exposed to this whole world of literature I hadn't ever discovered. And I ended up going to graduate school, in some part because of Pamela Jennings. And I'll tell you why. She hates the story, but you know I got to tell it. So Pamela and I are from the same town. And our parents knew each other, but we didn't know each other. And when I graduated from college, it was a big deal. I was the first in my family to graduate. Well, I'm graduating from Berkeley. And we did black graduation, and our parents see each other. And my mother asked Pamela's mother, well, what is Pamela doing after? And she's, oh, she's going to get an MFA at, were UCLA? UCLA. And so my mother turns to me, she goes, you could go to graduate school? Up to this point, it's like everyone's celebrating me, and now my mother says, you're not doing enough. So I always thank Pamela Jennings for putting the idea of graduate school. But I didn't have plans after I graduated, like many students, right? I didn't know what I was going to do. So I took a job as a blank assistant one. Does that even exist anymore? The blank assistant one? The most dehumanizing title there could possibly be. And I sort of just worked around in different departments. And I then we used to call these things not casual appointments, came up in the Student Learning Center to oversee the tutorial program. And so I took it. And so I ran tutorial services at Berkeley, and then I branched out into tutorial services for languages, and I had a great time. You know, it's really fun. It's like being a yenta. You match students with tutors, right? You know, you schedule. And so there's, you know, those of you who work with me know that one of the things I love is what Helen just kind of like put things together, right? So solving the problem of which is the best tutor for this student, that was really fun. Then we did a reorganization. And I have to say, in my career, reorganizations have really been opportunities for me. Reorganizations and restructuring have not been scary. There was a reorganization, and an opportunity came up in the Athletic Study Center.
and I was approached to apply for it, to be the tutorial coordinator for student athletes. There were really great things about this job. The office was awesome. The bad thing about this job was that it was a Sunday to Thursday night, 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. job. So the schedule was in the morning, because athletes have very rigorous lives. Don't let anyone fool you. It's very, very hard to balance being an athlete and being a student. So they generally start early in the morning with conditioning. They then take classes in the mornings, like 8 to 1. They then go eat, right? Then they go and they start working. They do. They need treatment, they get treatment, they watch films, they practice. They have dinner, and then they come back and study. So you've got a building full of very, very tired young people, not all of whom want to be doing their homework at 6 or 7 o'clock at night. So that was the job, and it was enormously fun. So I'll tell you a little fun part of that job was I spent 2 of those years babysitting Jason Kidd. and I should say, he was you know, really just a wonderful young man, but you have to make sure that they stay eligible for their sport. And they have to travel, and some sports travel a lot, and basketball is one of them. So when basketball traveled, it was important that the students stay on task. So I would travel with basketball, which was something I didn't really like, because I like to, my husband will tell you, if you ask him what I like to do as a hobby, he will just fall out of his chair and go, he doesn't have any hobbies. She reads and she thinks. That's what she does. But, you know, I go on the road with basketball. So the first time I went on the team, there was a lot of papers due. Some history 7A had a lot of papers due. So I needed to write to run study table on the road. And they happened for the first time to sweep Washington and Washington State for the first time in like 50 years. So what does that mean I have become? I have become good luck. The bus can never change. So everyone who is on the bus for the sweep past the bus, stay on the bus. I said, no, I have a job. I have tutors. I have a husband. You've got to be on the bus. It was nice to do that. It took me away from work, and the players were really, really gentlemanly. So when I would come down for breakfast, they would leave the newspaper for me without the sports section because they didn't read any other part. They would show up for dutifully for study table in a hotel conference room. And the time that they forgot me at Oregon, I think in Corvallis, where they left me at the stadium, they realized it when they got back to the hotel, and to their credit, they all stayed on the bus to come get me. Yeah, they all stayed to say, oh, we forgot, we got all the way back to the hotel, we're like, you're there. But no, they wasn't on the bus. The bad part of that job, and what, you know, what I, the lesson for me in that job was that my manager didn't like me. My manager didn't like me. For lots of reasons. Some were racialized. But for lots of reasons, she didn't like me, and I didn't really understand that. So there came a time when I received a complaint from a student. And the student complained about some inappropriate behavior toward him. And it's my responsibility, as you all know, to report that. And so I did. And immediately when I reported it, I was placed on administrative leave. And it came down to, and I think of this as a blessing, actually, and what's sort of helped me and propelled me in my career. I got traded to another department. I know you didn't think they could do that, but they can. So because I had done nothing wrong in my job, they couldn't fire me, although they really wanted to. I can tell you, she really wanted to fire me. So they ended up trading me to early academic outreach. For their administrative assistant. And my boss, who was my boss for many years, said it was like getting a stallion for a mule. I'm like, oh, you're just. But one of the reasons he was willing to take me was that he'd seen me on television, because I'd have to go to the game, too. And he'd see me sitting behind the bench. So I felt like I knew you. So I ended up coming to outreach. And, you know, that was a really traumatic time for me in my life. I was pregnant. I was on administrative leave. I knew that things weren't going well in that job, so I had applied to graduate school. thinking, oh, let me just get out of here. Well, I've gotten admitted to graduate school. And so I had to figure all of that out. And so it was really, really stressful. But it was wonderful to be in EAOP because what I could bring to EAOP was that perspective of what happens to students when they're on our campuses. Right? What's it like in math and English? What do they need to do? What do they need to know and be able to do to be successful when they come to UC? So it was an ability to make an immediate contribution. Having said that, they were highly skeptical. Nobody wants somebody they're forced to take. So building trust was really difficult. But one of the things that I had thought in that time was that everybody on this campus knows how bad things are for me. And this trade was not to, you know, it wasn't from, you know, the Student Learning Center and Chavez Center to Wheeler Hall. It was from the campus across People's Park, downhill against to the basement of the Baptist Cemetery that flooded every winter. So it really felt like I was being just, you know, pushed aside. But it was really wonderful because I really got to understand how schools work, what the university does in schools. And like many people, I had no idea that the university helped high schools. And I've come to understand, and I hope we do, this is a critical part of what we do. It's our job to educate the state, to feed the state, and keep them healthy. And it's part of our land-grant mission, going all the way back to the Morrill Act, that if we are to set the standards for the state of California, we darn well better help the kids meet them. So this work is critical, and yet I knew nothing about it. And it was all the way across the park. I'd step over the needle.
Yeah.
all the way across the park. But it was an enormous opportunity for me. And then we had Proposition 209 passed. Mm. And the state, in its wisdom, decided to give the university tons of money. Now, do you remember how much boatloads of money?
It's $120
million. $120 million. And every campus had to come up with a plan for this money. And so I got to be
which
on the...
a lot more money back then.
Which is a lot more money back then. And that's how I got to meet Nina and Liz Palma. And also, you know, the leadership of student affairs and of the university, because this was a big deal to have this kind of plan. So I had an opportunity to demonstrate and learn new things, right? So putting that plan together and making some real critical mistakes, like realizing there are things about how the upper level of the university works that are very data-driven that weren't really in my wheelhouse. So I remember, this is slightly embarrassing, but I remember coming up, we needed to project something. We needed to project the number of high school students who would be eligible after 5 years, and we had to do some attrition. So my husband, many of you know him, he's a mathematician. So I said, honey, I need you to make this chart for me. And so my husband says, okay, well, you need to do X. I'm like, no, just make it for me. Right? I just need to put it on page 5 of the report. So he says, no, you really should understand. I said, no, just do it for me. You know what's happening. So he says, you really should know how to do this. But I don't need to know. I just need to put it on the table. So we get into this meeting, and the director of financial aid asks how I submitted my to project these numbers, and I'm like, yeah. And I make some gobbledygook. And he was a kind man, Richard Black. And so afterwards, he said, always need to know where your data came from. Point well taken, right? So I know where my data come from now. So we were successful somewhat at Berkeley getting those funds. In the meantime, my supervisor had moved over to the Office of the President. And he said to me, he said, I want you to come to the Office of the President. I said, I don't want to go to the Office of the President. I've only been there once, and it was a scary place. It was a scary who wore suits and ties and just seemed to show an awful, awful. And you know, he says, I plan to retire when I'm 60, and I want you to succeed me. So it was a succession plan that brought me to the Office of the President. And I point out how deliberate that action was. Now, keep in mind, I'm also in graduate school. I'm working on my PhD. I'm not making much progress, right? I'm doing all right. And I said, but I have to finish my PhD. How am I going to do this? I've fallen behind at this point. And he goes, well, we'll think about how you work. And so instead of thinking of your work day as 5 days a week, think of it as 7. I said, why on earth would I want to do that? But here's what he knew. He knew that if I needed to get time to write, and if I thought of the work week as completely inviolable, I would not go to class, I would not go to the library. But if I understood my schedule of 7 days, then I wouldn't feel bad if I went to the library at 3 on a Thursday, Mm. Right. So giving me that space to think of my day, my week, and my work week different helped me finish. And so I finally ended up finishing, which is so because finishing was an important part of the succession plan. And so when he retired, I assumed the role of director. And that was my, I really like to point out that idea of that champion, that person who really takes you under his wing and really tells you the good and bad of things. So the next restructuring, so I stayed in there in student affairs for many years. And then we had we must be strategically dynamic restructuring. Do you remember that one?
Yes.
That was the one that brought the consultant from the consultant who said something that I'll never forget, that in this restructuring we would have brain space, right, as we reorganize all these things. But one of the things I've learned about restructurings is that they are opportunities because there will be gaps. Because people respond to restructuring differently, and some people will see it as the clarion call to leave, and that creates gaps in organizations. And one of the things I knew that I was good at being a program manager. I was good at putting the pieces together, of aligning the services with the people. I had a good reputation with the campuses, so they generally give me what I needed to have. What didn't I know? I didn't know how the budget worked. I didn't know how resources were disseminated. I didn't understand how HR, how did the people who are here get here? So there was an opportunity. Everyone fled in the department, and the vice president didn't have anyone to do budget or to do HR. And so some of us stepped up and said, well, you know, I can do people. And Liz Holloman said, well, I can do money. And we said, we can help you. And that chance to help, I wouldn't say we were entirely great at it, but it was an opportunity to get a lens into how the organization worked. And equally important, it was an opportunity to help our vice president maintain what she needed to maintain in a very, very difficult time. My husband still laughs at this, a department administrator. I can barely count, right? What could you do to be a department administrator? So I became department administrator. And then the opportunity came as part of that restructuring that a set of services would be spun off into a different department. And I get a call from the provost at the time, Provost Pitts, and he says, I want you to start a department. I said, okay. He says, it's going to be called Education Partnerships. I said, educational? No, Education Partnerships. I like that better. Okay. And I need you to have this done like 2 weeks. So start a department in 2 weeks? I said, well, okay. So we started Education Partnerships in 2009. And we hired a vice president, vice provost for Education Partnerships the next year. And I had the opportunity then to be a chief of staff to a VP. And that was enormously illuminating because one of the other things I've learned is how important it is to observe how your manager works and to try your best to align to that style. So our VP was a faculty member from Santa Barbara, and he operated like a faculty member. So there were things that he wanted that made absolutely no sense, but he wanted them anyway. And one of the things that we realized about how he worked was that for him, we would give him briefings. You guys know how this works. You give them a briefing. And he would fuss at it. He would always fuss at it. I don't understand. And I realized he didn't see the data. He wanted to see the data that was beneath the briefing. And I would say, you really don't have to do that. Someone else is handling all that. So we said, all right, he needs to see the data. Once he sees the data, then he needs to come up with a hypothesis about that. And then we need to go from there. So we had to change the way we worked in order to accommodate that need to start with all the pieces, bring it into a hypothesis, and take it. Whereas we say, where do we want to be, right? And then how does everything fit to get us there? So just sort of shifting that style. He ended up leaving, and I was the interim for a long time, probably longer than was comfortable. And then I was appointed to the position of vice provost for Education Partnerships, which was really fun. Because we do great work in academic preparation and outreach, right? If a student is in one of our outreach programs, the likelihood that they're coming to the University of California is almost double that if they aren't in a program, right? We are serving thousands upon thousands of students, and we're making college real for students who otherwise would not have that opportunity, who would be like me, right? Not really understanding that I lived between the University of California, Davis and the University of California, Berkeley. I'd never seen either. And I lived for a little while in Colorado, so like for 3 months. I'm like, I've been there, so I'm going to go to college there. Just, you know, or picking colleges that aren't really aligned with their interests or with their abilities, that specter of undermatching. So we do enormously good work in this area. For about $250 a year per student, we have very little resources, and yet we impact the lives of thousands of students. So I'm having a great time being vice provost for education partnerships. And then they tell me I have to be vice provost for diversity. I said, oh, no, thanks. I don't want that. Right? And the provost and president say, no, you will, because this is our this is what we need from the university. So I became vice provost for diversity about a year ago, and that has been a roller coaster. In preparing, so I think you'll see that I've developed my skills as an analyst. I've developed my skills as a program coordinator, as a program manager. And now I'm in this really interesting transition from manager to leader. So a lot of the things I do really well don't actually matter anymore. It's not important that I be able to do them. And so that transition, the things I love to do in my job, right, the things I love to work on, are actually no longer things I'm supposed to work on. I'm supposed to delegate and coach other people to do this. So this is an interesting transition that I hadn't really thought about, and that I imagine there are ways to prepare for it. But it is a different transition. It's a different way of spending your time. It's a different way of thinking about your day. It's a different way of thinking about how you interact with people and how you try to guide them and coach them to excellence. And so, you know, if one of the things I love to do is I love to write reports and briefings. And that's not really my job anymore. I have to let other people write them. So then if other people write them, what do I want to do? I want to edit them, which drives them crazy. So I've had to learn to shift, sometimes successfully, sometimes not so much, in making this transition to being the vice provost. But one of the things that, even in this role and in all of the roles, we had a consultant come out to work on our identity. And we came away with a vision statement that those who live here, are here, thrive here, and lead here as our vision for where we want diversity and engagement to be. And that aligns so perfectly with everything that I've done in my career. Those who live here are here, they thrive here, and they lead here. So I want to close by sharing with you, let's see, Elisa, I said I'd only do this at the end, right? I want to share with you just a little bit about, or maybe not. Is it on? It's very possible it's not even on. There it goes. I told you that I have a husband, and I have a couple of kids. Didn't really talk about them, but I'll share. So I have, this is my husband and my sons. Let me see. They are very, you know, I'm so bad at this. Okay. That's my husband and my two sons. My older son is 21, and my younger son is 16. But I want to share with you, how many of you are parents? Awesome. How many of you stalk your kids on social media? Okay, yes. Because I've taught June and Elena how to do this. Yes. I do that. And I ran across this posting, and it's sort of embarrassing. I hate the photo, but you'll understand when I show it to you. I don't know if you can read this. So this is my son, Trey. My son, Trey, is 21 years old. And I ran across this on his Instagram feed. And this is what he's not really talking. He's very much like my father. He doesn't say much. But to 1,000 people that he is apparently friends with, he says, I don't see mom as much as I would like to, and a basic pick-stitch collage is the least I could do to show how much I love and appreciate her. Like, I wouldn't even be going to UCR right now if my mom didn't tell me to apply and that I'm good enough to get accepted. And I thought, really, you didn't think you could go? So this is a child who has lots of resources, right? He has parents who are college-educated. He has been, he grew up on the Berkeley campus, and yet he doesn't think that he has the skills, knowledge, and ability to be successful. He has replicated thousands of times in this state. And I wanted to share that with you that, for me, there's no such thing as work-life balance. It's work-life integration. And that to see that my son told 1,000 people, even if he didn't tell me, that it mattered to him that someone helped him and that it made a difference for him meant the world to me. So I want to close with that and say thank you very much for your attention, and I'm happy to answer questions or do any of that for you. Are there any questions I can answer for you?
Yeah. In your new role as a leader and visionary, what's your vision? What would you like to see as your impact?
What I'd like to see is that we've made a substantial impact on the presence of African Americans at the University of California. That we have turned the tide, we've moved the numbers so that there is a critical mass of students who are African American on our campuses. I think this is one of our really intractable problems for a lot of reasons. Some having to do with where students are in the state, their low numbers relative to overall populations. But a lot of it also has to do with access and opportunity for students in the schools that they attend. So the ability for us to expand our reach to more of those students, to help more of them see themselves as college material, to prevent the undermatching, which is enormously high in African-American communities, to present the University of California as a beacon of light, right? And I sort of make fun of, you know, I really did park behind Grinnell with my dad, walk on campus and go, cool, I'll go here. But that shouldn't be the way that students make a college decision. And so it's really to get more of those students here. That's number one. That's our number one priority. The second is for everybody to recognize that diversity is a shared responsibility. When I first was appointed the vice provost, so when I was appointed vice provost of education partnership, it was a transition. I just sort of moved into that role, right? But when I was appointed vice provost of diversity, it was like a deluge. Everyone expected that I would solve everyone's problems. I'll be honest, I was unprepared for how everything hit my plate, and I didn't really have a good way of sifting through that. So I spent, how long would you say? I spent about, yeah, it was a little longer than I want to admit, huh? Elena's like, yeah, it was a long time. That's when the cobbler pie shop idea emerged, right? I spent a long time sort of trying to figure out what that meant. And so I need you all to see yourselves as the chief diversity officer for whatever part of the world you own. Whatever part of the world you own, that's your job. It's your job. So it's to convince, cajole, to encourage you all to think of that as your role. And the third is in general, to raise the awareness of the University of California as a place of opportunity for the students here in California. That if they don't come here, they're not going to have a connection to us. When they're taxpayers, they're not going to want to support us, right? That we need to open access to this university to more students. And we're fortunate to be able to get some one-time resources this year to be able to help with some of that, but we need a lot more. But, I'd say I want all of you to see yourself as playing that role for whatever group of people you are, and to see us as a resource, as a hub, as a space to help you think through problems and challenges, but not to solve them for you. Not to solve them for you, but for us all to embrace that.
So how necessary is it to have a master's or a PhD or other graduate degree to rise in the leadership structure here at the UC? What if you don't have such a degree?
Yeah. It's a good question. I think there are definitely changes. I know that credentials matter for me. But they matter for me for different reasons. One, I'm an African-American woman, and that sets the bar a little higher. I'll just be honest, right? There are high barriers to entry to positions that have vast scope of control. Here's what I recommend to people. I'm serious. I got a PhD from Berkeley. I had two kids, a husband, and a full-time job.
Oh, my gosh.
All right? You all can do this. You all can do this. Now, I will tell you it took me 10 years. It did. But it took me 10 years. It took me 10 years in large part because I'm kind of lazy. Right? I'm kind of lazy. And I have had no kids. The kids had to be born. I had to be, you saw my sons. They're very lovely and they're very sweet. But I never read baby books to those boys. I'm like, what am I reading? That's what you're reading. You're reading Cotton Mather today. Yay! So I just feel like when you see that a position requires an advanced degree, really, really think outside the box about how you can make that happen for yourself. I really do. I think that honest, transparent, open conversations. And I wasn't going to come to the office of the president because I didn't think I could finish. And that's not to say outreach work is easy. Outreach work is all day, every day, right? So you're at schools in the morning, you're back in the office in the afternoon, and in the evenings, you're at parent workshops, and on the weekends, you're working. And there were many occasions when I was at Berkeley where I'd be standing in front of a group like this with a kid on my hip talking about A through G, okay? And it wasn't fantastic. I mean, it didn't always feel good. And when it was done, though, I actually cried. I remember sitting on the edge of the bed and crying. And my husband was like, why on earth are you crying? I said, I don't know what to think about now. I've been thinking about my dissertation on, Black theology and the rise of nationalism for 10 years. I have read Richard Allen's autobiography 1,000 times. I'm not going to do that anymore. And that's a weird feeling, right? I think that those credentials, that experience is important. That doesn't mean that it can't happen. There are certainly people here who don't have those things. But I think that anything you can do to advance your education, particularly with the 2/3 fee remission that they offer at the University of California, you should do. You should try. Let's go here and then go back.
You mentioned barriers to entry in terms of advancing with PC or on the planet, and then the idea of undermatching, I think, can be applied to a career as well.
Absolutely.
And so what advice do you have for people, particularly women, in order to overcome both those, to find a position that aligns with their experience, potential, et cetera?
Yeah. I find, in my experience in talking to people, I find that we talk ourselves out of a lot of things that if we just had a conversation with an influencer or a decision maker, it would be different. So I know there's many, but I won't even point to you in the room, who have said, I can't do this. I also notice I'll have positions open and I'll call people. I think this is a good job for you. And you should apply. And they'll say, oh, no, I can't do X. There'll be 10 things on that list. And they can't do one of those things. No, we need to reframe this and think differently. So a lot of it is really be honest with yourself about what you're talking yourself out of. And if you don't have a good perspective on that, ask somebody. The second is to find a champion. And I don't mean a mentor. I mean a sponsor. I mean someone who's going to take you arm in arm. I'll be honest. When the vice provost for education partnerships came open, I did not want to apply for that job. I'm a really good deputy. There's a lot of freedom to be had and a lot of autonomy to be had in helping someone else. And so I was very accustomed to that second role of being invisible and behind the scenes and very comfortable there. And Provost Dorr said, you won't apply for this. And she really sort of like wrestled me to it. And as hard as it has been, I greatly appreciate her championing of me. And that means telling my story to other people, too. It wasn't just talking to me. She is championing me. Ben Tucker, who was my director here for many years, same thing. Margaret Heisel, same thing. Dennis Galagani helped me. So it's asking people not just to mentor you. Can you sponsor me? Can you help me? Right? But be really clear about what your strengths and weaknesses are and be really open to criticism. So I mentioned how my manager didn't like me when I was at the Athletic Study Center. She really didn't like me. And so I moaned and groaned and complained and cried to people. And I remember crying to a gentleman named Mike Hardy. And I said, I don't know my Satan doesn't like me. It's just awful. And he looked at me and he said, you're not managing her. I said, what? He goes, you're not managing her. You are just reacting to her. You need to manage her. You need to understand how she works, and you need to align yourself with that, because that way you will have integrity no matter what happens. So one of the things that she wanted to be was she saw me as a threat, because these were black men and I was a black woman. These are boys, right? But in her mind, that was a threat. And I needed to mitigate that threat if we were going to be successful. I was not successful in doing that, and so I had to move on. But I think it really is about understanding and managing up. Managing up, and I don't think we do it very well. We sit back and go, well, they won't do it. No, figure it out. Figure out how they communicate, how they work, what their style is, and then do the calculus. Can you align with that? Because if you can't, you've got to go, right? You've got to go. So, you know, it is about understanding what your assets are, determining who your champions are, and really explicitly getting them on board with you, and managing up, which is enormously challenging. It takes a lot of time, but it's so critical, because if they feel that you're in sync with them, that you're supporting them, then they're more likely to reach out and help you. Other questions? Nicole.
I just wanted to bring it back to the play school students and the issue of undermatch. And in the absence of young people, especially those underrepresented groups and communities, having a mom such as yourself, what are the things that you've seen that work the best?
First is students really don't know, they don't understand what college is, especially if they're first generation. They have five ideas of what you should do in life, right? You can be a lawyer, many of you are lawyers. You can be a doctor, be an engineer. So they don't really have a sense of the ways that people can benefit from a college education. You can be a chief outreach officer, right? They don't really understand what those things are. So some of it is exposure. And for us, it's about sometimes stepping back from how we understand things and putting ourselves in student shoes. So many students want to study criminal justice. Google criminal justice at UC and find out how many criminal justice majors you're going to find. But we have them, right? Right, Jim? We have criminal justice majors. It's just we call them different things, like social ecology. Right? So some of it is deconstructing. What does that mean? It's about deconstructing what majors are. And there's also, you know, this taking away or problematizing the direct link between college and work. Right? College and work. And the third is demystifying what it costs to go to college. Right? So I have a nephew who is a pretty typical kind of student, right? So I'm looking at his transcript in August of 2015, and I realized this kid is eligible. I had no idea this kid was eligible. So his mother didn't think he was eligible, and his father didn't think he was eligible, and I'm looking at his transcript, and he's eligible. But he's missing an SAT score, right? It's August. So in order for him to apply to UC, what does he have to do? He has to take an October SAT. Which he does, right? But you know what that means, right? Really low school. So he gets admitted to Chico, and he gets admitted to Merced. And immediately they take Merced off the list. Why do they take Merced off the list? Cost, right? They take Merced off the list because of cost. Say no. First we're gonna go visit Merced. We're gonna let you see it, and then we're gonna let them decide, meaning the financial aid offices, if you need to take Merced off the list. Right? So Merced and Chico come back with their financial aid offers. And guess what? Merced. It's cheaper to go to Merced. Where is he going to be on August 24th? At Merced. Right? So, you know, it really is about problematizing the relationship between work and school that sort of narrows down options and how they think, demystifying financial aid, and building awareness and confidence. They take themselves out of the UC picture really early. They are told by counselors and other people, UC isn't an option. If you ever have a chance to visit, did anyone have eighth graders? just going from eighth to ninth grade. Yeah, so there's generally an orientation or transition. The high school counselor will come to the middle school and talk about college. And I went to one of these with my younger son, Andrew. And remember, these are eighth grade kids, right? So next year, they're starting fresh. There's no GPA. They don't have anything. And the high school counselor says to this class, he says, one of the parents says, well, how do you, what about Berkeley? How do you go to Berkeley? What does he do? Oh, it's so hard to go to Berkeley. You need to have a blah, 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 and blah, 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 blah to go to Berkeley. And so I start to move, and my son says, oh, don't do it. Please don't embarrass me here. I'm like, I have to, son. I have to save these children. I had to say, well, that's actually not the case. And blah, blah, blah. So you have to do that whole thing. But those messages are insidious.
Mm-hmm.
They're insidious, and it's our job to break them. So if you are ever in that, you just want to know, you come talk to me, right? You come talk to me. Because it is important that all of us share in helping demystify the university for the students and stop perpetuating this idea that it's this so far removed and difficult and inaccessible place, because we all know it's not, or it doesn't have to be. Yeah.
You mentioned earlier students being undermatched. I'm with the community college system, and we know that if our students do really well in community college, that they will backdoor into the UC system, mm-hmm. especially Berkeley City College. We're starting to get out-of-state students who are selecting the community college
how it works.
As their college of choice mm-hmm. and take out-of-state fees.
So they establish residency.
So that they get 1 year and so they can backdoor into Berkeley. Again, as I look at the amount of students that transfer, and I work with the student leaders a lot, many of them are still not thinking that they can do it or they can't afford it. But the other issue that we're looking at that is more so you can get the students in, but how do you keep them? What are the comprehensive services that keeps that child from that student from becoming invisible, and then one day you look up and they're not there? Because that's the issue that we're really, really struggling with.
So, you know, every campus does it slightly differently, but they do all have student support services, right? Starting with Summer Bridge, right, so they can acclimate. And we're starting to do that for community college transfer students because we see that as an important mechanism for them to get rooted and meet people and be oriented to the kinds of services. I used to run tutorial services, and one of the things that one of the hard things about that was trying to help students understand that tutorial didn't have to be a last-ditch effort to save yourself, that you could be really proactive and treat learning as this wonderful thing you were doing. We have advisors. We have special programs for students depending on their how they come into the school, like educational opportunity, EOP, right? They're small. We have cohorts. Some of the campuses, what I liked about Riverside for my son who ended up going there and graduated, right? Just graduated, double major, in 4 years, with, like, you know, linguistics and global studies. At home right now, without a job. But I think it is this first year experience, right? Creating small groups of cohorts of students and working with them in those cohorts and designing classes and advisory and tutorial and success planning all around that cohort. And we're seeing that a lot more on the campuses. And it's also inviting the campus people to talk to them while they're community college students so that you can treat the student services as a journey that starts not just when you transition to the university, but even when you're starting to meet. So what's the connection? If you're an EOP at Berkeley City, well, guess what? That's going to transition for you when you go to Davis or Berkeley. And here are the people. For people of color, one of the things I do, they'll say, who's Haitian at Berkeley? Families want to know. Their families want to know that there are people on a campus who will take care of your kid. And so I keep a list of who's who. Who's Haitian is Martine Guillaume over in the linguistics department, and she will do this for you. Because that's a very important resource. Our families are often afraid that our climate or that our students will be treated negatively, and they want to know there's somebody there. And so part of our job is to make sure you know there is somebody there doing that reassurance. But that student services journey can start from the time, if they're planning to transfer, let's start that now. Let's introduce you. Let's tell you where that stuff is. Let's bring those people there. so they can be reassured that they'll be okay. But, you know, these are big campuses, and the perception is no one will notice me. We will notice you. We will notice you. Other questions? Well, thank you all for your attention.
Thank you, Beth.
Oh, my God.
Thank
you, too. All that about you.
Can you have a line now?
Oh, my God. I was like crying half the time.
Really? Why? Yes.
Yeah, so no, sad. When
wonderful.
I read that social
traded?
Media.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I cried, too.
Oh,
no, but don't tell him. I saw him, though.
No.
I hear it.
Secret.
Everything I hear.